I'm Benita Lee.
And I'm Esther Frost. This is How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. Today is Tuesday, May 7th, 2024.
Coming up, we explore indigenous science combined with Western science, its indigeneity.
Indigenous worldviews were deeply ecologically kin-centric, that we literally understood the land, the air, the water, the plants and animals as our kin. That would have 100 years ago been called indigenous romanticism. Today, we call it evolutionary science and ecology.
This week in Boulder, scientists are meeting with indigenous leaders from around the world. It's a multi-million dollar federally funded program that's been going on for several years, called Rising Voices. The goal is to combine indigenous knowledge with Western science to find better ways to address the extreme weather and climate events that are affecting indigenous communities. The Rising Voices sessions are closed to the public, but a leader of this event spoke with us earlier. Daniel Wildcat is a professor at Haskell Indian Nations University in Kansas. Wildcat is the author of the new book, Indigenuity. Here's Daniel Wildcat speaking with How on Earth's Shelley Schlender.
We need indigenous voices. You know, we talk a lot in higher education about working in silos, thinking in boxes. There are people on the planet who, their intellectual traditions, they never worked in silos. They never thought in boxes. That's sort of what's happening now in modern science, this understanding of the deep relationality of all life on this planet, this beautiful Mother Earth. And I think indigenous peoples have always known about that deep relationality and the importance of understanding that. I believe in this century, some of the most important voices in the climate change discussion are going to be indigenous voices because they hold knowledge and wisdom that is desperately needed today.
Not every reservation is being well preserved for nature.
Oh, absolutely. I think when you have to look at the situation of our Native nations in the United States today, you see a whole range of responses to modernity and the industrial age, and now we might say the post-industrial age. And I think tribes are going to make their decisions, exercise their sovereignty, as they have the right to do, in ways that they think will maybe be best for their children 7 generations into the future. My point is, if we think deeply about those intellectual traditions that reside within indigenous peoples, we'll see that there's much knowledge and wisdom that's very applicable to the kinds of problems we face today. There's that apocryphal quote attributed to Einstein, which there's no evidence Einstein ever said it. And that is, he told a colleague, remember, you can't solve problems with the same kind of thinking that created them. I think there's really an opportunity now for what I like to call indigenous ingenuity, exercises of indigenuity. We need to use some of our ancient knowledge and wisdom to help address very modern problems that often we had no part in creating.
Who's going to be there at the conference?
We're talking about the Rising Voices Conference at NCAR in the first week of May. Rising Voices started over a decade ago, and the idea was, let's put together the best modern physical scientists in the world who are tackling climate change, and let's put them together with some of our traditional knowledge holders, people who lived on the land in a place for generations. They know a lot about that place. They know a lot about those ecological relationships, the relationships of the land, air, and water. And so we said, let's bring them together. And so that's what Rising Voices was created to do. And the big NSF proposal, which Haskell now has, a $20 million NSF project in their Coastlines and Peoples project to create the first research hub that looks at the impacts of climate change on indigenous coastal peoples in the United States and her territories. That would not have been possible without building those relationships with that larger, more robust scientific community. And so I think it really shows that there is a lot of good work that can happen if people are willing to create the spaces, reach out, and find where it's where we can develop honest, respectful kind of discourses and discussions about the future that, you know, we all share in this age of global climate change.
It's part of what you're trying to do to wake up what you believe are Indigenous values.
Mm-hmm. I think they have them already. We get so caught up in the modern world that sometimes we cannot be mindful of how our own values, beliefs, knowledge systems must inform the work we're doing today. And I'd say most Indigenous, I won't say all, but a great number of Indigenous peoples, they never would have thought that humans were the center of this beautiful planet. They understood we were a part of it, we had a role in it, but the world didn't revolve around us. And I think it's that deep relationality. Even my good friend and mentor, the late Vine Deloria Jr., used to say, you've got to understand Indigenous worldviews were deeply ecologically kin-centric, that we literally understood the land, the air, the water, the plants and animals as our kin. It's kind of interesting. That would have 100 years ago been called Indigenous Romanticism. Today, we call it evolutionary science and ecology. And so I like to jokingly say, well, you know, it's not a competition, but I'm glad to see that some parts of Western science are finally catching up with Indigenous knowledge and wisdom. We need places like Haskell. We've got young people that want to be entrepreneurs, that want to be scientists, that want to be engineers, but we don't want them to think they have to leave their tribal culture and intellectual traditions at the door once they enter the academy. Haskell's a place where we encourage them to bring those traditions here because we understand the education we offer will be incredibly richer if we look at how those things can often be not divergent, but sometimes convergent and complementary to the best modern science today.
You know, you have indicated that you don't think it's woo-woo to teach people things like songs and dances.
Mm-hmm.
It has a great deal more depth.
A tremendous depth. There's something today, you know, among cognitive scientists, there's a group of cognitive scientists, they have a theory called the 4E theory. And the 4E theory is that much of what we know is embedded in what we do. It's enacted knowledge. It's embodied knowledge. That is a powerful idea. Any parents can tell you their children learn a lot by watching what you do, and you don't have to say a word because you're embodying the knowledge, you're extending it in your activities. And I think this is something we've lost. We don't really pay attention to what we might learn in the world around us, not just our human relatives, but our plant and animal relatives, the land, the air, and the water. I think Indigenous knowledge is inculcate the importance of an attentiveness to the world outside these walls and therefore encourages us to be good relatives in a world full of life that evolutionary science indeed confirms we are related to. We lived in a world full of relatives, not resources. We honored inalienable rights as much as anyone, liberties that humans are endowed with by, quote, their creator. We understand that. But we also understood those liberties and rights are groundless unless they're coupled with inalienable responsibilities. You take those first two kind of insights and think about the kind of systems then we would build. We spend so much time arguing about who has the right to what resource, when if we modeled justice after Indigenous traditions, we'd be asking ourselves, well, are we being responsible good relatives to that balance of life in this world. Move from a world full of resources to one full of relatives. Let's counterbalance inalienable rights with unalienable responsibilities. And then we could really talk about resilience. We could talk about resilience. It's not just restoring something that we once had, but making something better. We all want something better for our children and our grandchildren. I believe this is indigenuity. This is taking that ancient wisdom, applying it to the modern world. We're not just restoring something, we're trying to make life a little better on the planet.
I'm Benita Lee. Thanks to Shelley Schlender for that report. Daniel Wildcat is a professor at Haskell Indian Nations University and the author of the new book, Indigenuity. Wildcat recommends tackling ecosystem challenges by combining indigenous knowledge with Western science.
I'm Esther Frost. This is How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. As another example of combining indigenous knowledge with Western science, the Nature Conservancy has been sponsoring a small group of indigenous college students at their Canyonlands Research Center in the Four Corners region, the rural area where Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah meet. Up next, we'll share a report that originally broadcast on our sister community radio station, KZMU. In the Science MOA program, you'll hear research students discuss biocrusts. So, Benita, what exactly is a biocrust?
Well, Esther, when I first heard the term biocrust, I admit I thought of a French bread baked in a solar oven. That's not what it is, and our producers did a little digging, and no pun intended. A biocrust is made of cryptobiotic soil. Crypto means hidden, while biota means life. So a biocrust is a delicate web of microorganisms that slowly grow throughout dry soils. What biocrusts do is they enhance the desert's retention of water and nutrients. They also knit the soil together, making it firm on the surface and much less likely to blow away.
So if someone goes hiking on the trails at Arches National Park near Moab, do the trails tend to be dusty?
Probably so, because all the people walking the trails through the park have destroyed the cryptobacteria that knitted the soil together.
And on an established trail, I gather it's okay if the trail is dusty?
On an established trail, that's okay. But people who go bushwhacking off the trails can do terrible damage to biocrusts. Dune buggies and ATVs also do horrible things to desert biocrusts.
So if I'm at Arches National Park and I want to help protect the cryptic biotic soil, stay on the trails.
You've got it. You stay on the trails to preserve the biocrusts.
Thanks, Benita, for that explanation. Let's go now to our sister community radio station, KZMU, and their program, Science Moab.
I'm Alex Fenigworth. In the summer of 2023, seven Native college students spent 7 weeks in Southeast Utah and Southwest Colorado. Today, we're talking with two of these students, James Johanna Burns and Shundane Smith.
Nawa Kwa Hatso Amtoya. James Johanna Burns Akan, Koigu Masape Chawi. Hello, my name is James Johanna Burns. I am enrolled with the Kiowa tribe, but on my mother's side, I also am Caddo and Pawnee, and I go to school at Fort Lewis College here in Durango, Colorado. I am majoring in environmental science and minoring in environmental policy, and I'm really excited to be here.
Hi, my name is Shundane Smith. Shundane Smith Yanishia Tachin Inishna Kithachini Bashishin Tuahana Dashache Maidesh Gijni Dashanele. I am from Farmington, New Mexico, and I'm currently at San Juan College, and I am studying for my associates in biology. And I'm from the Navajo Nation tribe.
What initially drew you to the nature program?
It was an internship for Native students and getting that opportunity to meet with other Native students who are in a similar field as mine.
What drew me towards the nature program was my professor was letting students know about research opportunities that were available in the Four Corners area. And of course, I was the only Indigenous student within the class at the time. And so he had brought the nature program up and he was just pointed straight at me, was just like, I expect you to apply.
I'd love it if each of you could tell me more about your capstone research project.
My capstone project was done on how ant colonies impact biocrust and dryland ecosystems. And what initially started that entire idea was how burrowing insects impact biocrust. And no one could really give me an answer. And even doing some research on my own, I couldn't find a lot of studies done. Doing the research was really eye-opening as I got to learn so much about biocrust, which was a brand new topic for me. I have not heard of biocrust before joining the nature program. Along with that, I have my own cultural significance with ants, as that's where my creation story come from. My people, we came from ants. Incorporating that knowledge and that respect that I have for ants, along with wanting to do the science and do the research, I found that ants do affect the stability of biocrust. But there was a few things that led me to thinking that there could potentially be a relationship between ant colonies and biocrust that kind of just grow with age to where they form a symbiotic relationship.
James, can you tell us a little more about how did you actually test for these interactions between insects or ants and biocrusts?
So I ran soil aggregate stability test, or a SAS test. I would choose a location that had an anthill and that had biocrust around it. I initially started as wanting to test the biocrust and how it holds together when you dunk it in water, essentially. And so biocrust got a 6 on the soil aggregate stability test, which is the highest it could get. It's really stable, really holds on to water and the soil around it. And then I did a gradient from the biocrust to the top of the anthill. And I found that the top and the side of the anthill, it wasn't stable. It fell apart in water as soon as you put it in. But when you got to the base, the number, I think, jumped from a 2 to a 4 or a 5. That kind of just shows that there is a bit of a gradient from the anthill to biocrust on the soil stability and how much water it actually holds. I noticed that some of the younger, or what seemed to be younger ant colonies, there was a giant ring that biocrust wouldn't grow in. But some of the older ant colonies had biocrust growing right up to the top of the anthill. So that's kind of what led me to thinking that there's some relationship there that's more than what's just being shown.
Shandine, can we hear more about your capstone project?
My capstone project is initially on the legacy and solutions of the abandoned uranium mines on and around the Navajo Nation. What had inspired me to doing this capstone project specifically was seeing all these videos and documentaries about the abandoned uranium mines on the Navajo Nation and how detrimental an effect it has on residents and Native people living near and on the reservation. So the idea of we have to do something about the uranium mines came to mind. And then I came across something that said cell walls of fungi can break down uranium or like radioactive waste. So that was like immediately like, I want to learn more about this. It ties into like my family history as well. My paternal grandfather was a uranium mine worker. Just hearing the interviews from my father and my aunt about what he did as a uranium miner and then the detrimental health effects of after and what they saw after up until like he passed away was really the full driving force of what made me want to continue researching about it.
Yeah, so what did you end up learning from all your research?
While it was very amazing and interesting to see everything compiled together and seeing it as one complete thing, but it was also very saddening when I would read the testimonies and the claims and the stories and how similar they are and how they continue to be similar to how my grandfather passed away. With that aside, you can't just delve into these things and then just be left with like these sad feelings. I also delved into like what is being done about it today. What basically I found out was that the abandoned uranium mines aren't as abandoned as I initially thought, is that there are multiple organizations and government organizations that are working to remediating and cleaning up these sites. So that's what really brought peace to me. And then also what I think would be a solution to the abandoned uranium mines, such as like using micro remediation and bacterial remediation, and also maybe incorporating those bacterial remediations with biocrusts to mitigate the spread of radioactive waste from natural rainfall or snow.
And do you have any plans to continue any of this research?
Oh yeah, definitely. Meeting with all these USGS scientists, it's inspired me to become a biogeochemist as well.
So. Whoa.
That's cool.
Yeah, and actively working on these lands and remediating the lands on and around the mines.
Students in the nature program have talked about this idea of walking in two worlds or two-eyed seeing, this kind of experience or way of living. On the one hand, you have your indigenous culture and identity and background. You kind of see the world through that one eye. And then you might also see the world through this lens of science and some of the things that you're learning at school.
Even here at school and in my courses and learning a lot about Western science and how to go about doing different scientific methods to get your research that you need. But growing up, I mean, hearing the traditions and things that my family taught me on how to view nature and just how to interact with it always comes into play when I'm in class or discussing case studies or going over research. How I view things, other people don't. They see it as, oh, this plant, like I'm just going to take all of it and use that to do what research I need. But I've always been taught that not only is it just a plant, it's something that's living, it's something that's alive, and you need to pay that respect to it. So whether you give an offering, and even if you do harvest it, you don't take all of it. You take just what you need. Some of my classes, we do talk about that traditional knowledge that a lot of tribal people have and how to incorporate that. But my professors, they're not indigenous. All their knowledge comes from their readings. They don't have any actual experience with it or how to use it. They can talk about it, but they haven't lived it. Hearing them try to explain it, it's kind of off-putting in a way. Even on my final projects, I just did one on food sovereignty yesterday on how to incorporate that more onto the Fort Lewis campus. And I definitely had to break down just how a lot of people perceive food sovereignty and try to include that indigenous aspect behind it, and how if you want to enact food sovereignty on a local level, you have to decolonize that perspective of it and incorporate those traditional teachings that a lot of indigenous people have. You have that respect for the food that you're eating, you're growing, or even harvesting, and you're able to use it a lot more than just a food source or something to eat.
For me, in terms of like walking in two worlds, I've had a lot of time to sit and think about it because I don't do well with cognitive dissonance, especially going towards nuclear chemistry. There's a lot of talk, especially around the Los Alamos labs. It's like one of the best places where you could learn nuclear chemistry is at the Los Alamos labs, but with also with like everything that's around Los Alamos labs too, I have that cognitive dissonance where I'm like, I want to learn to try and help, but I have to go through like a certain institution that adds to the very thing that I'm trying to clean up or I'm trying to mitigate against the Native people or the Navajo people on the Navajo Nation specifically. How can I still honor my ancestors and my indigenous traditions while also trying to learn Western science? The best thing for me, especially if I get caught in a bind where I don't feel okay with what I'm doing or what my future plans are, is that I sit with my family or I sit with elders and I talk with them and I tell them my concerns and I'm like, is this really what would be best for our people? Was this really what would be best for our land?
Now that you've been away from the program, is there anything else you just want to talk about, things that you learned?
I think the one biggest memory that really sticks out to me was when we were all sitting down with Arnold Clifford, and he was saying how we should share our culture and our traditions with other people outside of our culture. At first, that tilted my head because growing up, I was always told by my elders, these traditions and these ceremonies should always be kept secret and should be kept away because they're precious. So they would always tell me like never to talk about it with other people. But then when I heard Arnold talk about it in a way, we should share it. We should be able to talk about it with other people because that's how we keep it alive. And that's kind of like where it clicked in me, where it's like, you know what? He's right. We can keep it within our respective tribes, but we should still be able to share it with others, get other perspectives.
Would each of you want to leave our listeners with one piece of advice, one piece of wisdom, just some sort of closing words that you'd like to leave our listeners with.
Take the opportunities as they come up. I mean, there's so many different ways to get involved and to get that knowledge that you seek, but you can't do it by just sitting on your butt, because you never know. It could just be something amazing that's just waiting for you.
Don't be afraid to talk with your elders, and don't be afraid to sit there for hours listening to them. It takes a long time, but don't be afraid of it. You'll learn so much, and it's so great.
I'm Esther Frost, and you've been listening to an excerpt from Science Moab. Science Moab is broadcast at KZMU in Moab, Utah. KZMU is part of Rocky Mountain Community Radio, a coalition of non-commercial radio stations in the Mountain West. We'll link to their entire show on our website, howonearthradio.org.
That's all for this edition of How on Earth. Our executive producer is Shelley Schlender, who also produced this show.
Our theme music was written and produced by Josh Cutler. Additional music from Carlos Nakai.
Visit our website at howonearthradio.org to find past episodes, extended interviews, and you can subscribe to our podcast.
Questions or comments? Call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. For How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, I'm Esther Frost.
And I'm Benita Lee.